Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a special episode with a special guest. I'm very excited to have Casey Halpern on from Sync Neuro. So welcome, Casey, and we would love to, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about yourself and your company.
Thank you so much for having me, Diana, Natalie, and Ryan. Thank you for coordinating. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
I'm actually right outside an operating room, so just let me know if it gets noisy.
Oh, wow. I want to hear more about that. Yeah.
It's usually a quiet area.
I've ever had a guest coming from an operating room, never mind in a blazer, right? Like, this is a whole different level of...
Well, hold on. Stop the train. I got my scrubs on, too.
I like that. I noticed that, too. It's perfect, right? Yep. As any person will. Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like I was born in scrubs with a sport coat on, so it's kind of my uniform. But it's nice to be with you. You know, I'm a neurosurgeon. I run a research laboratory. You know, I was first in practice at Stanford in California, now back in my hometown in Philadelphia, Penn. I started this company before my time here, started kind of as a Stanford spin out, related to my work in the brain and as it relates to our body's metabolism, our brain and body's metabolism. And I only do one type of surgery as a neurosurgeon. I do deep brain stimulation, which is a treatment you may have heard of for like Parkinson's disease or severe tremor. And my lab has...
It's like, well, the people are playing the violin while you operate, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's how we know this. Yep, okay.
I had a YouTube on one of my patients that did that once. It's an amazing procedure. And when I first saw a deep brain stimulation surgery, actually it was in this operating room here, Pennsylvania Hospital, same room, eighth floor, room eight, because it's a large room and it's leaded, so you can get good recordings in the room. I never really wanted to do anything else except learn about how deep brain stimulation could help other conditions. And at the time, this was sort of the pre-Ozempic era, way before Ozempic, I believed that I could use deep brain stimulation to treat and learn more about obesity and how the brain and body interact. And obviously, we moved, through human trials now, and now there's new medications available that are very effective, and we're still trying to figure out exactly the future of that. But in doing that work, we were looking for sort of biomarkers. And when I say biomarkers, most people think about, like skin biopsies or blood draws. But I mean like electrical, brainwaves, signals from the brain that represent something important. And neuroscientists, neurosurgeons have studied the link between these brain signals and a variety of different sort of health states. But I was really interested in metabolism as it related to obesity and type 2 diabetes, and figured out pretty quickly through surgeries where we have wires, actually placed tiny little wires in the brain, that we could actually take those brain rhythms and decode them. And we actually figured out that certain rhythms represented our blood sugar levels in real time. And, at first it was an amazing sort of basic science finding. It validated some knowledge from neuroendocrinology that the brain somehow is the barometer for our body's metabolism. But it was really the first demonstration, to my knowledge, of this kind of continuous tracking of our blood sugar. And so we published that. And, my team of scientists brought to my attention that it didn't really matter where the wire was in the brain and where we were recording. It was a diffuse signal that we were getting. And when you get these types of distributed phenomena that kind of spread throughout the brain, you can usually detect that on, on the scalp with like a little sensor called EEG. EEG is a technology we use in epilepsy and sleep disorders. We don't use it for monitoring diabetes, but we believe that that would be something that would be feasible and also an advantage to the available technologies, because it would be presumably entirely non-invasive. And that's really when Sync Neuro formed, was to really develop a customized EEG device that could be a wearable, something that would be more comfortable and, you know, non-invasive and a better alternative, at least for certain situations, than the standard glucose monitors. And we've been working on that ever since.
Wow, I have so many questions, and I can sense Diana's questions coming across the screen. We're not even in the same room. Sometimes we're in the same room, sometimes we're not. Yeah. Okay, so we wouldn't have to invade the skin. It would be on top of the skin? Yeah. Like I could put my glucose sensor back here.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's, you know, in general, the signal that we capture seems to be very prominent over the temporal lobe, which is sort of the side of the brain yep. where you're pointing. And so actually that also just is an area where you could put a little sensor behind your ear on that skin area where there's no hair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, you know, you can feel the skull there, and that's an area that you can get these brain signals. And that's also an area where somebody would be willing to wear something, you know, most of the time.
This is amazing. And what about the idea of accuracy then? Because that's, well, you know, so one of our challenges with sensors that are applied every 10 or 15 or however many 7 days is that your first day is kind of, you know, we call it scientifically wonky, right? And do you trust your sensor? Do you put it in ahead of time? All the questions, right? You know this, but like we do, right? Is tell me about like that first, you know, when you look at it, how obviously you're doing this with glucoses and you're measuring both to prove that this event is something that you didn't make up, right? But how accurate is it compared to, let's say, finger stick blood or, you know, for your measurement?
You know, we're getting there. You know, this is algorithmic, you know, and we are measuring right. a brain rhythm that we believe is actually upstream of what you might be able to kind of detect in the interstitial fluid, which is how like Dexcom and Abbott and others, you know, track blood sugar through that, through a needle, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, we believe it represents the bloodstream's glucose levels, and it is a true real-time representation of it. And so while it's algorithmic and we decode these brain rhythms because we can't otherwise speak the brain's language, those rhythms nevertheless reflect real-time blood sugar. So in some ways, it's a direct assay. It just requires a little algorithm to spit out a number so that we can actually make it actionable. We don't see a calibration period being necessary for a number of reasons. We are algorithm training now, and you know, the more data we have, which is all of this EEG data, you know, we link it to blood sugar levels, we validate it in that way, and the more data we get, the more accurate we are.
This is really amazing. I'm curious, like, in terms of, I guess, wear time and everything, like, or actually even where it is, like you mentioned, behind the ear. Like, how important is it to get the exact spot, or is there kind of some wiggle room if it goes a little higher or a little bit lower?
Yeah, you know, we were worried about that. You know, I'm a deep brain stimulation surgeon, I mentioned. It's all about precision, you know, like if I'm a millimeter off, my patients don't do as well, you know. So for me, like, that's so critical. And we really sort of spent a lot of time, you know, trying to optimize this. Turns out it's quite forgiving. And, you know, that location behind, you know, the ear, you know, there's a reasonable amount of space, even if you have glasses or sunglasses or even a hearing aid, where you can still fit our sensor or they can be worn simultaneously without difficulty. So our users have taken it off, put it back on without sort of a degradation in the signal. It's reproducible. The device has sort of a stud finder readout. So if for any reason that signal is not there, it will tell you and it'll give you some guidance. You can always put it on the other side or you can move it up or down. So luckily it's quite forgiving. I wasn't certain that was going to be the case, but we're pretty confident of that now. You know, we started originally with full, you know, scalp EEG, which is like in a, you know, epilepsy monitoring unit. You see, you know, these electrodes all over. And obviously that's not something somebody's going to wear, but we sort of use that high density full head data to try to figure out, you know, where this needs to go, the spacing of the electrodes. And it turns out that flexibility was, you know, made this actually quite feasible. And it makes it something that now users can do on their own. And, you know, they can take their monitor on and off as they see fit. You know, for example, you know, if you take off a Dexcom, you have to throw it out, you know, and that's pretty expensive. And then you got to prick yourself again, which gives some people a little pause. So this becomes a little bit more of a just an easier solution.
Well, and I love the idea that because you've said, okay, this happens across the brain, the glucose signaling you can find in other places. So if you did move it up or down, it won't matter as much because it should still be able, and you know, unless you're down here, right? If someone places it in and it says, hey, this isn't working, you know, it should be not one's exact spot, right? Because I could see patients not being able to do something like that. But I also, if you're going to guide, yeah, wow, okay.
So I've got, you know, I've got so many more questions.
I know. Go ahead.
So with CGM, you know, typically the glucose range it can measure is like 40 to 400. Do you see something similar with this? Would it be a wider range or a narrower range?
It would probably be similar. You know, our goal right now is to provide a stable glucose reading that reflects your glucose levels at the level of a Dexcom or an Abbott device. You know, I know that there are limitations with these devices. We can solve for these things. We focus on the postprandial peaks, meaning when somebody has a meal, obviously you know this, when the sugar rises, our interpretation of their accuracy, these companies' accuracies, is they're particularly accurate during those moments. And so we try to focus our algorithm on those moments. And in that way, we think we can eventually even achieve better accuracy, a more stable signal with less noise. But at the same time, you know, trying to just match their accuracy as a first pass is a great goal to have, which is what we're working on now.
Yeah, along those lines, I mean, interstitial fluid has that lag time. Would this have a lag time since it's not interstitial fluid, or would it still because it's based on an algorithm?
Technically, Dexcom is based on an algorithm, as is Libre, right? There's an algorithm to that sensor. So the challenge is that the interstitial fluid glucose shifts a little bit separately than the blood glucose, right? Right. So does your algorithm, really, I think the question, Diana, is can you create an algorithm that can overcome that? Or does the tracing come so quickly because the glucose is actually changing and it's that brain wave is measuring that change pretty quickly? Does that go away or almost?
So, you know, this is actually pretty cool. You know, we're trying to be reasonable, you know, and the opportunity to track quote unquote real time blood sugar I mentioned earlier, that's a real thing here. You know, in an upstream of what's happening, you know, like glucose is in the bloodstream where we're measuring it. It's it hasn't permeated, you know, into the interstitial fluid through the capillaries. So, you know, we believed in the beginning that we would be able to anticipate maybe by 15 or 20 minutes what a Dexcom or Abbott can do. I can tell you that early on, we just really tried to match it. I can tell you now, looking more closely at our data, and more to come on this, obviously. If you look at our data at the exact same moment as a Dexcom collectively, you know, the whole cohort of data, and which is obviously growing, you know, we do pretty well. You know, our sort of growth, like overall MARD, which is a reasonable way to measure accuracy, is around 10 or 11. And that's when you look at Dexcom in real time, meaning matching those peaks and the exact timing of Dexcom and Abbott's devices. However, if you look at 20 minutes before, so now all this is, you know, retrospective, you know, looking at the data that we've collected, if you actually look at our glucose readouts during the 20-minute anticipatory or the lead time in front of that Dexcom device, it's actually more accurate. So it suggests that we are reading something true real time and that we can actually be sort of give people these readouts before Dexcom or Abbott, any continuous glucose monitor that uses interstitial fluid. We can actually track sugars before they can.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm assuming this would connect with some type of mobile app that the person could see their results. Any idea how often a person would need, like, I'm assuming, would this run need to be charged each day?
So
okay.
We, you know, there's a number of sort of strategies and, you know, what do people actually want, you know, and the majority of our users seem to be interested in a rechargeable that they don't have to charge that much. So, you know, we our goal is to make this, you know, one day, one recharge a week. and then, you know, keep it on continuously. Some of our users, you know, may not be entirely dependent on the reading, so they can wear it when they want to. They can take it off when they want to. Others might be more dependent, so they may have to wear it more continuously, maybe until they get their health under better control, for example. Depending on how much they use it, obviously, will dictate how much they have to charge it. But right now, our goal is once a week.
Wow, that's wonderful. And then size-wise, because as a user, I would want something smaller. I'd charge twice a week for a smaller device.
Yeah. Right? No, I think
that's like you're trying to, I mean, truthfully, right? People will say, I like that one better because of the size, because of the shape, because of the what? I mean, like people put pumps in the old days because they were pink, right? Yeah. No algorithm, no nothing. And it's like, but they had a feel towards it, right? So I would charge more often personally if it was a smaller device.
Yeah, so we're getting there. You know, the first gen sensor we have out there right now for algorithm training is, you know, not what we're going to launch to the world.
Right. Yeah, it's not supposed to be, right? Yeah.
It's probably, if I had to measure it, let's say about 2.5 centimeters long and about 1.5 centimeters thick. And it basically fits perfectly on average that sort of skin area behind your ear. Mm-hmm. The beauty of our sensor is that it's probably about 8 millimeters thick and it's soft. It's soft and flexible. So it's not rigid and hard, which would be uncomfortable to wear. The material inside it, the electronics, they're all flexible as well. We use flexible carbon. So it not only is more comfortable to wear, which was a real priority, because if you're not willing to wear it, then our accuracy that we've been working on, you know, for a while is not going to matter. But the not just the wearability, but the accuracy is better because it's flexible, because it contours to everybody's scalp and skull and everyone's, you know, shape that's a little bit different. And especially if you move it a little bit, you know, we want to still make sure we have good contact with the skin. And so having that flexibility is really critical. And I think this is where other sort of head-worn sensors like this have failed, is they were more rigid and uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, that's not much different than some of the hearing aids, right? So like in a, you know, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
The beauty is hearing aids go more and more into the ear because they're historically behind it. But as they're getting into the ear, it leaves a little more real estate for us.
Exactly.
And that area behind the ear, it's great for brain signals. It's great for other things too. And so we find ourselves very privileged to have that sort of location because, you know, we can track more than just brain rhythms as well.
Yeah, I was curious on that, like if you're looking at other analytes, like other than glucose, because, you know, we've got ketones coming soon, a dual glucose ketone sensor. And I know other companies have expressed interest in things like potassium, cortisol. So I'm curious if you guys are looking at any other analytes as well.
We are looking at all of them, especially, you know, where we see, you know, great need, and it could be need that, you know, sort of augments our opportunity for people with diabetes. Mm-hmm. We see this as a platform technology that can also scale to other problems, whether they're related or not. You know, we're really interested in sleep disorders. We're really interested in sleep apnea. You know, stroke prediction is something that we believe our sensor can do beautifully. And so if you think about those two problems, these are indications, they would require, you know, some work with the FDA most likely. And, they would require metabolites that, you know, go beyond glucose. And so, for example, you know, monitoring things like oxygen saturation, monitoring, you know, other vital signs would be very, very critical. And that's something we want to make sure we are able to do. We are working on it. Admittedly, we're a small team. And so, you know, startups historically, you know, if they're not focused, you know, they don't get it right. And so we have to balance focus with our sort of big vision and, you know, being a little one step at a time, but maintaining that sort of vision, you know, throughout to accommodate, you know, all of these indications we want to go after.
Awesome. Wow. So along those lines, I am curious, at least for the glucose component, how far out do you think this could be where we could see this?
You mean like from a commercial launch?
Yeah, like where my patients can
get right now. Right? Yeah, exactly. Well,
Well,
how about this? How many people have you tried this on first before we get to commercial launch?
At this point, it's probably dozens.
Okay.
And then And in dozens, you know, we get 24/7 data, some of them for 2 weeks. And so if you think about how many, how much data that is, it's actually pretty tremendous. We want to get to hundreds. And that's kind of what we're doing right now. We're raising money to get to the hundreds because, you know, do we need thousands? Well, you know, maybe we'll be even better if we have thousands. But truthfully, our power calculations that our computational scientists have done for us demonstrate a little bit of a sort of plateau once we get to the hundreds range. Mm-hmm. So we think that we can get there pretty quick. That's what we're doing now. We're you know, enrolling users into our algorithm training as we speak. You know, and when we get to a certain threshold, you know, we would then launch. We anticipate that could be, you know, perhaps a year from now. I'll admit that this is something that's kind of new to our, you know, plan, but there's a possibility that we would be able to launch as a wellness device early on, you know, very strategically. We really want the FDA to, you know, give us the opportunity to have clinical claims. You know, the original sort of idea here was that we would be like an artificial pancreas that was entirely non-invasive, or at least guiding a non-invasive artificial pancreas. But we're starting with type 2 and prediabetes because we see a huge need there. And we can also get into the marketplace a little faster, perhaps even grow our, you know, algorithm training even further. But the FDA pathway is, you know, very much part of the plan, and we are actively working on that. But it's possible if we have this opportunity with the health and wellness, thanks to some new guidance from the FDA, perhaps we can get out there even sooner.
That is so exciting because to have incredible. A non-invasive option for people with prediabetes and type 2 would really, I think, and then you'd be able to collect all this real world data from the years if you got into the wellness space.
And something that they could take on and off, which we see with a lot of people with prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, that they want to wear it some of the time, that's real. So, you know, one falls off and then they don't want to put it back on because they don't care. You know, they don't. They could put it back on, right? So there is a sense that this maybe you'll actually have more engagement just because of that alone. That would be really interesting.
We believe that very much. You know, in our market research, many of our users wear one of these, you know, CGM devices, you know, and more than 80% of them said that if we launched a product that we described to them, they would switch because they don't see a way to, you know, continue to purchase these devices. They can't get insurance coverage for it. They know they medically need it. They'll benefit from it. They want to have that information, but they also don't want it to go through their skin, and it's super expensive taking it off and on. So ours gives them that type of flexibility. So we think that this is meeting a sort of mass market need. I'm curious, you know, I'm a clinician too, you know, but I typically see people with Parkinson's in my clinic, and you guys are entrenched with, you know, clinics with people with diabetes. And we have a function that I want to sort of pressure test with you to see if you think they would find it useful. You know, the brain is a prediction machine, and I've alluded to our sort of platform technology having multiple opportunities. If we just think about diabetes, you know, one of those is giving people like a morning forecast for the day, like the weather forecast. Like I look at the weather every day. When I lived in California, I didn't, but in Philadelphia, I have to look at the weather every day on my phone. What if I looked at my metabolic forecast for the day? Like, for example, we seem to be able to forecast how high your sugar is going to go every day, like your high sugar reading for the day, which may represent on average that day, you know, a relative hyperglycemia day, you know, and maybe that's related, for example, to poor sleep or what you did the prior day. So our morning forecasts are able to give people that kind of insight before the problem happens so that they can then more proactively address it. And we can give them personalized recommendations because we're collecting a lot of physiological data, but also behavioral data. And we can link them. This is what our algorithm, you know, does in an automated way. So we can say to you, listen, like in the past, your lower sugar days, or maybe your healthier days were associated with you doing more cardiovascular exercise or avoiding these kinds of foods, taking a nap. You know, we know sleep and metabolism are highly integrated. So, you know, if we gave people those types of recommendations first thing in the morning to kind of give them some tools for the day, is that something you think your patients would use?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would as a person, right? Just say, okay, you didn't sleep well last night. You didn't get your exercise in yesterday. Your glucoses are predictably going to be higher.
Yeah.
So, but I can't get into a patient's chart every day and look and see whether their sleep apnea machine was worn or not. This would say to them, hey, today would be a great day to get a walk in. Today would be a great day too, right? Can you get to 5,000 steps? Can you? That your glucoses are going to run higher is a huge, you know, I think it would be a huge motivator for a lot of people.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think it'd be really exciting. I think the key is like the accuracy. I mean, like I wear an Oura ring, right? I get a readiness score for the day. There's whatever the AI advisor. I don't know if there's a lot like sometimes it says it's like 60 and I feel great, right? Or vice versa. So, but I think the hope would be, right, this is like brain waves, right? So it'd be more accurate. So I think if we could trust that accuracy, it would be a really powerful tool.
Yeah.
It's we think accuracy is the number one most important thing that we can do. In order to get that accuracy, we need wearability. So these are the two things that we're very focused on at the company level. We want this to be ubiquitous and helpful for people. And we think our users are our toughest critic, right? Like, you know, if they get a reading that is not as accurate as it probably, you know, as they feel it would be, because people can, you know, they can finger stick, right? They can actually see how accurate is this thing. We want them to just be mesmerized by that accuracy. And so, you know, that's part of our sort of, you know, our rigor, our brand, you know, like this is, you know, it's a consumer play. Like we want this to be out there, you know, and you know, penetrate the market, you know, significantly, you know, more than medical devices typically do. But at the same time, we're going to have that rigor, that level of accuracy. And that's what we're working on today to ensure that people are happy with the readouts we're giving them.
That's amazing. Yeah, this has been a really great discussion. We want to thank you so much, Dr. Halpern, for coming on. I think this might be the first time we had a neurosurgeon as a guest. So we thank you for that. And we thank all of our listeners and viewers for joining us today. That wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.
Such a pleasure.